You're listening to IsraelScene.com.
And you're listening to IsraelScene.com.
Listening to IsraelScene.com.
Seen through the eyes of Steve, that's myself.
And you're on.
Two characters passionate about everything that happens in Israel.
IsraelScene.com.
That's right, you are listening to IsraelScene.com. And I'm Steve.
And I am Yoram.
And it's all yours.
It seems like a long time ago, but I think it was only last week that I interviewed journalist Yossi Klein Halevi. At the time, the news was the invasion, the war in Gaza. Since then, of course, I think starting the day after the interview, we have a war in Lebanon in the north. In some ways, that makes the interview even more poignant, as we didn't know, neither Yossi or I knew, that the next day the headlines would be the same, only the words, the names would be changed.
Wonderful. We're sitting here in the office of Yossi Klein Halevi, right off of Emek Rephaim in Jerusalem. Yossi's had a long career in journalism. I first met him, he was writing for the Village Voice in Manhattan, hardly the most Zionist newspaper in the United States. Came to Israel, wrote for the Jerusalem Post, wrote for the Jerusalem Report, and is now the Israel correspondent for the New Republic. The other day, Yossi, on the website of the New Republic, you had an article dealing with this latest flare-up in Gaza, and I think the title had something to do with, like, not enough, as if the army moving in and doing what it's doing is not enough. And I wanted to ask you, what else is there to do? What is the situation, and what is there to do more?
Yoram, it's looking a little better than when I wrote the piece. When I wrote that article right at the beginning of the operation, it seemed that it was going to be another heavy metal display. We'd be sending in some tanks and shooting some artillery into open fields and pulling out just a show of force, or what they say in the army, lafgin nochechut, to demonstrate a presence, which to my mind has less than zero value. It has negative value because it only shows our self-imposed impotence. But what the army has in fact done is more impressive than how it initially appeared. The fact that the army is choosing its targets and playing a kind of hit and run, staying for a couple days in one area, moving to another area, the mobility of the army and the continued presence of the army in Gaza is something more, let's say, creative than we've seen from the army, and that we had the right to expect from this new and amateurish government. So I withdraw some of that criticism. What I would like to see, and I understand why the government is not doing this yet, is for the government to make good on its repeated threats to assassinate Hamas leaders, quote political as well as quote military, and that's really one and the same. The troubling part of the government's performance is to continually make threats. I wish they would shut up. Every time Olmert and the defense minister Peretz offer another threat, it just makes my skin crawl. So if you're going to say that Israel considers Hamas leaders fair game, then do something about it. If you feel that that would jeopardize the life of Gilad, the soldier who was kidnapped, then shut up, don't make threats, and postpone the decision about whether to resume assassinations against Hamas leaders until Gilad is free. But one way or another, have a consistent policy.
How do you feel the whole the withdrawal from Gaza, the potential withdrawal now from the West Bank? How does that seem to you?
I was a very enthusiastic supporter of the unilateral withdrawal from Gaza for a simple reason. I felt that it meant that we were withdrawing, first of all, from the two political delusions that held us prisoner for almost 40 years. One was the notion of greater Israel and the occupation, and the other was the notion of peace now and a comprehensive negotiated solution. Neither of those options, unfortunately, is available to us. They're both ideally wonderful options. Who would not love to have biblical borders? Who would not love to have comprehensive peace with our neighbors? Neither option has been proven to be realistic. Therefore, unilateral withdrawal meant that A, we were withdrawing from Greater Israel physically, and B, the fact that we were doing so unilaterally meant that we were withdrawing in principle from the idea of a negotiated peace. Because if you have a partner on the other side that you can trust, you don't unilaterally withdraw. You go to the table and you get something in return for your concessions. And this is something that the right did not understand about those of us who supported unilateral withdrawal. I remember people on the right, friends of mine, would be telling me, do you, after everything we've been through, do you really believe we're going to get peace by withdrawing from Gaza? The fact that we are unilaterally withdrawing from Gaza means that we realize we won't get peace. So that's an idea that somehow did not sink into the right. Now, the question is, when we confront further unilateral withdrawal, in principle, I remain committed to unilateral withdrawal for the same reason I supported in Gaza. We need to end the moral disaster of the occupation. We need to end the demographic threat to Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. We need to end the illusion of a peace process. And that means acting unilaterally. We need to determine our own security borders based on what the army tells us and not on any other consideration. Those are all significant reasons to continue to support unilateralism in principle. In practice, though, something has changed since the withdrawal from Gaza. And here I would say two changes. The first is the rise of Hamas, so that if we were to withdraw in Judea and Samaria, what the result would be not simply a Fatah terrorist supporting state, but an Iranian proxy, which is the Hamas regime. The result of that would mean that Israel would be faced with Iranian proxies on all three of our land borders: Hezbollah in the north, Gaza to the south, and Judea Samaria to the east. And that is a security danger that, to my mind, is close to being an existential danger. So until we bring down the Hamas regime, and I hope that that's what this operation in Gaza is ultimately going to do, bring down the Hamas regime, then we can talk about unilateralism. There's one more issue, though I did say there were two issues that have come up. And the second issue is the aftermath of unilateral withdrawal from Gaza. And here I don't mean the fact that the Palestinians continued sending rockets across the border. I didn't expect anything less of the Palestinian leadership. But I did expect a much stronger Israeli response in these last 10 months. When Sharon said that we will tolerate no rockets flying over the international border once we withdrew, I, in my naivete, believed him. And I really thought that we are going to establish a principle of zero tolerance of any act of aggression, whether the rockets fall in an empty field or whether they fall, God forbid, on a school. The principle would be the same. We would treat whatever government is in power in Palestine as directly responsible. We allowed 10 months to go by of wasted opportunities, and our deterrence as a result has gone down to zero. And what we're trying to do now in Gaza, in part, is reclaim some of our lost deterrence. You cannot impose a left-wing territorial policy, which is withdrawal, without a right-wing security policy. If you just try to go on withdrawal, you will end up falling on your face, and you'll lose the support of the Israeli public, so that it is in the interest of the doves to act hawkish. No other policy can work. And that's, I think, that what we've learned over the last 10 months is that if there's going to be any repeat of unilateralism on the West Bank, it better be a lot tougher and harder than what we saw in the last 10 months.
I know that you're in contact with a lot of foreign journalists who call you and who interview you and who read what you write. How is the How is the world looking at this, and how do you think this will develop, and how do you think this will affect our ability or our actual behavior in Gaza?
I think it already is affecting our behavior. We're walking on eggs in Gaza. And I think so far we're doing a pretty good job in balancing a strong policy with care for civilian casualties. Obviously, mistakes will be made, are being made. But given the fact that we are in Gaza in a pretty strong way, I think the results of the last 2 weeks have been impressive. And that's partly because we know we're being watched. We might not act as carefully if we weren't being watched. So I suppose we have something to be grateful for the criticism. In terms of how the foreign media is seeing this, I think that it plays out along pretty standard lines. That those who have an open mind about the conflict are ready to give Israel some benefit of the doubt. We got a lot of points based on the fact that a whole society adopted this one soldier and that we really were ready to go to the limit and beyond the limit for one guy. I was interviewed by a British reporter who was just incredulous. She said, I've just never seen anything quite like this, and this wouldn't happen in Britain. And so there was a certain, and I don't think she was necessarily pro-Israel. In fact, I imagine she isn't. But there was a certain grudging respect that much of the media gave us, which was unexpected. At the same time, there's been a tremendous amount of the usual nastiness. I had one of the worst interviews that I've ever had with an American television journalist who behaved like a prosecuting attorney. And literally asking me, how can you people arrest the elected democratic leadership, etc., etc., etc.? And I answered the question. He kept coming back to it until I finally had to say to him, next question. The answer is, there are several answers. One is an answer that I don't really like giving because I don't like dragging in the Holocaust, but it's a truthful answer, and that is that Hitler also won democratically. And I feel less squeamish about invoking Hitler when speaking about Hamas, because Hamas is a genocidal movement, and all that is stopping Hamas from being more successful at genocide is its own powerlessness. These terror attacks, these suicide bombings, for me, are kind of many expressions of the genocidal impulse. That is as many Jews as they're physically able to kill. And so I don't have, personally, I don't have qualms about comparing Hamas to Nazism. I generally don't find it's a useful thing to say. And because it brings in the usual suspicions of the Jews are getting their Holocaust backs up again. And I think that our case against Palestinian terrorism is strong on its own merits without bringing in the Holocaust. But if you're asking about elections, mitbakesh, as we say in Hebrew, it's almost self-evident. The second answer that I think is right, and the government has been very good about putting out this particular point, is that yes, they are democratically elected, but they are democratically elected terrorists. And given the fact that we are the preferred target of their terrorism, there's no reason to treat them as a legitimate democratic government. And it's interesting that after Zarqawi was killed in Iraq, the only government in the world that issued an official statement of mourning and encouraging the resistance to continue was the government of Palestine. Hamas issued an official statement. The foreign minister was in Pakistan. He made a statement, and then the government made a statement. And that somehow went by most of the international community. There isn't another government on the face of the planet that I can think of that was stupid enough to mourn for Zarqawi. Even the Iranians issued a statement saying we're glad he's gone. Whether they were or not is beside the point. So Hamas, this government, is a criminal, genocidally minded terror regime that deserves to be treated on its own merits.
To step back for a moment, you talked about the concern for the one soldier, Gilad Shalit. In your article, you mentioned a reason for that concern, and I wanted to ask you if you would repeat that, if you remember.
Yeah. What I wrote was that the promise of Zionism, or the last promise of Zionism that remains a consensus among Israelis, the last bit of classical Zionism that most of us here continue to not just believe in, but actually live by, is the commitment to fight back against our enemies. And yeah, the point here really is that when a soldier is captured, I think two things happen in the Israeli psyche. One is that the basis of Zionism becomes threatened, which is an Israeli soldier represents the negation of Jewish helplessness. And to see an Israeli soldier kidnapped and held hostage, or in Ron Arad's case, the pilot, who we haven't heard about for 20 years, sold by Hezbollah to the Iranians, that is a blow to the solar plexus of Zionism. In terms of what this does to us as Israelis on a personal level, not an ideological level, we're parents of soldiers, future soldiers, past soldiers, and we all see in Gilad our son, and we're all asking ourselves, what would we want the government to do if he was our son? Everybody I know is asking that question. And you have to say to yourself, well, you have to weigh your politics based on that. And that's why I think a majority of Israelis, according to one poll that I heard about, supported the policy or the idea of trading prisoners for Gilad, which, I mean, on most issues this is a very hard line country, and there when it comes to our sons, which is really Gilad is every son, then you see people responding as parents and siblings rather than as voters for one party or another.
As we wrap this up, Yossi, how would you analyze or describe the status of in the country at this point?
The mood, where we're going, what this new government might do.
There's tremendous confusion right now, and I think Israelis are still in a prolonged ideological hangover. The settlement movement, which dominated Israeli policy in the 70s and the 80s, is over. The peace movement, which dominated Israeli policy in the 90s, or for much of the 90s, is over. And this government was supposed to step in with an alternative plan. Okay, we can't make peace with the Palestinians, we can't occupy them, therefore we're going to unilaterally disengage. But what we're seeing in recent days is not just a growing skepticism on the part of average Israelis, but also growing skepticism from within Kadima, from within the government itself. And I think I see Olmert as being increasingly besieged, and I frankly don't see him pulling off unilateral withdrawal, at least until the Hamas government is destroyed. If Hamas remains in power, then people like myself who want to support unilateralism will not be able to.
Thank you very much, Jesse.